Accession number 11281, wheel 10.
Mr. Kelly, wheel 10.
And they seemed a bit haughty to me, and looking at me as though, why should I be giving them orders when they've got far more service in than I had? And they'd been longer in the service than me. And that was the attitude that they adopted. And it was a bit disconcerting because they carried with them the air of knowing more than you. And they looked much neater than us because we'd been in the field for that long. And you tend to look a bit ragged and dowdy and not at your best, especially under the circumstances that we had been working under. But as I was saying, they were very, very loath to take any instructions from you. And when I had to take I must tell you this. When I was sent down to pick up the reinforcements for A Troop down to headquarters, and when I went down there, Captain Chaplin, if you remember, my first troop commander, who was then been a major on D-Day, was now a lieutenant colonel, and he was in charge of the commando then. Now that shows you the casualty rate, at least among the officers alone, that he could come from a captain, a wounded captain in Sicily, and by the D plus was a month after D-Day, he was a lieutenant colonel in charge of a commando, or half a commando anyway. But he was the CO then, and he was down at headquarters, and when I went down there to pick up our batch, I remember that there was one of the troop sergeant majors from another troop, Patriotic. This man was absolutely gone on it. And I remember him saying to all the people who had arrived, the newcomers, right, how many people volunteer to be a commando? And there's only two or three put their hands up. The rest had been just turned over, you see, by the Marines. And I did a commando course, physical fitness and that, and then that was it. But they weren't the true commando soldiers, you see. So he just said, well, that's all I want. So it wasn't even interested in the number that he should have taken. He only wanted the volunteers. So he took all the volunteers. Jimmy Crooks, his name was. Jim Crooks. Yeah, and he's a fabulous chap. Anyway, he takes just the volunteers, so we're left to, you know, you hit six or whatever it was. Go with him. And I took mine back, and then they were allocated between the various sections. And I think I got three out of the small number that we got. And one fellow was quite good, turned out to be quite good. And his name was Peach, but we called him Plum. I don't know why you have to change the name, but that's the way it went. His name was Les Peach, and I always remember him because he lasted up to the end of the war without any problems. And as I say, we called him Plum. But the other two were... I couldn't remember the names. I don't remember their faces, and they never lasted. They didn't last a day. I had to take them out, and Captain Stevens said, "Well, take them out on this patrol," and this patrol that we did wasn't very far out, and providing you followed the edge row, you were screened from the Germans, and then you just occupied the far end of the edge row and just lay there, and that patrol only lasted about 3 hours, and it was just a listening patrol, that's all, just lie there and listen, just make sure that the area in front of you was cleared and not being occupied by the enemy. And but to get out there you had to hug the edge rope. And of course, we told them very quickly, because they had to learn fast. And we said to them, now, if I shout mortars, get straight down onto the edge row and down to the ditch, and get down into any folding bit of the ground that you can, and get down. So, right, you know, it's a sort of a, you know, well, I say a sullen sort of thing, you know, the thing. That's the attitude that I got, you know. They used to have a name for it, some sort of dumb insolence type of thing. So off we went, and I only got out and moving down the thing, and of course watching what they were doing, I said, you must do exactly as I do. And going down, keeping this to the edge row, and then I heard, it wasn't that they'd seen us, it was just that it was one of these searching little probes that the Germans used to do, and periodically they'd, you know, you'd get a bit of a bombardment, and they might choose one area one day, you know, move it and gradually search the ground, you know, hopefully, you know, they would at least they'd torment us, even if they didn't cause any casualties, and we'd never know where they were going to drop them next. And we heard this plonk, plonk, plonk in the distance, the pops going. And I said, mortars, and gets down, knowing that I've got, you know, 10, 15 seconds, maybe more, you know, while it's in flight. So as soon as you hear it, you get out the road. So you get down, and you're waiting to see where they land. Of course, once they land, you know they're all going to land in that area, so it may not affect you. But when you hear the pop, you don't know where they're going to go, initially. So I waited there, and of course, they did come down by us. And they did drop to the rear of where I was lying, you know. And of course, moans about it. And these two fellas were hit. And of course, the chap behind me, the regular, you know, one of our own lads, one of the older hands. He said, I think they've been hit. So we went back to them. And sure enough, multiple shrapnel wounds. So we lost the two of them. And they had just arrived in action and hadn't lasted, you know, 10 minutes. Didn't even see the day out. So we lost them just through their carelessness. They just lay down where they were. Instead of, you know, getting into the hedgerow and getting out the road, but just, you know, to me it seemed that they were just being pig-headed. And on another occasion, the patrol that I took out in another direction. Now, this only happened to me, you know, these incidents. They were happening with others as well. The other troop section commanders, they were having the same difficulty with them. And, of course, in the patrol that I was doing this day was, which was again another listening patrol, but this was the patrol that was very close to the enemy, and you could see them. And in my this group I had, now you couldn't take your own men all the time. You had to have some out of somebody else's section, because you weren't strong enough to take that, and you denuded your own little defensive area by taking all your own men. So some of your men have to stay behind, and you take one or two of yours, one or two of another sections, one or two of another section, to make the patrol up. So I had this patrol, taking this patrol out. And Captain Stevens always came with you, see, on this one, to make sure that you all got in, and you were all safely in, and then he would come back out again, back to his troop commander's duties, you know, because... Well, although he did his patrols, man. He did his, but he was so personally involved, and he was such a soldier that he would make sure that these dangerous little patrols, and as I said earlier, he wouldn't ask you to do something that he didn't do himself. So, of course, he led off. Now, on that patrol, you had to pass through an area where the Germans fired fixed lines. Now, fixed lines were where they had their machine guns mounted in solid fixture positions. And all that the gun would do would traverse in an arc, a very small arc, on this mountain that it was on. Now, it wouldn't depress, go up or down, but it would go laterally, it would go from side to side. And they used that so that at any given time, they'd have an area covered, and all that they need to do was press the trigger. They didn't have to aim it. And they only had to press the trigger and move it back and forward sideways. And it would cover that ground that they wanted it covered without having to mess about. And they could take the gun off this tripod or whatever it was on and take the gun away and use it in a light roll in the normal way and then come back and just clip it back on again. And we had a similar type of thing. We could do with that with the Beren gun. And we could put on its mounting, sandbag it in and make this thing quite solid and secure. And then you could aim the gun and cover the ground that you wanted to cover. And even at night time, you would know that without aiming it, you were covering that area very accurately. So they had these fixed lines, you see, and you could pick out the fixed lines quite easy with experience, because it was the same marks getting hit all the time, and no higher and no lower. So as you were going through the trees, and they were like thin trees, like bushes and just spindly things, and the Germans, to cover that ground, had put it under fixed lines. So when you approach that particular point, you get down, and it didn't matter what time of the day it was, you didn't know when that fellow was going to put his finger on the trigger and fire a burst machine gun fire across there. So we always approached that point and lay down, and you crawled that distance underneath until it was safe to get either on your hands and knees again, or stand up or crouch. So you had to use the cover, and it was a difficult place to get to, but quite obviously being so close to the Germans, you needed to do a lot of crawling on that one, especially towards the end of it. And of course, coming underneath, when we got to this point, again, I remember them being told to do as we did. And we had had one of these fellas behind me, and behind them, of course, with the rest of the patrol spaced out and doing what they had to do, crawling along. So when we get to this place, Captain Stevens just gets down, and he doesn't say anything to me. He just gets down and he crawls on, and when I arrive there, I get down and I crawl on after him. And it was just so happened that while I was crawling, started to crawl, the Germans opened fire. Now, I won't say that you don't jump or you're not disconcerted for a moment. You are. And then a sudden burst of fire, and then, you know, it's hitting the trees just about 3 foot above you, and you know that it's not going to touch you anymore, so I just carried on crawling. And I carried on crawling until we were very near the point where we had to split up, and Mr. Stevens would put each man in his place. And I turned round, and there's nobody there. There's only Mr. Stevens and I there. And I couldn't think of what had happened. I hadn't heard any shouts or screams or anything like that. And I couldn't think for the life of me what had happened. So Stevens came back, and he gestured me to come forward. And so when he comes back to me, you know, and nobody there. So I had to crawl back. All the way that I'd come, and there they were lying there, because this first fella, once they started firing, wouldn't move. And he just stayed there. So, of course, I went to the fella behind him and said, what's wrong? So he said, I don't know. He said, I thought you just stopped. So I said, get him moving. So I said, do exactly what I do and follow me. I said, if I carry on crawling, you crawl. So he said, he was shooting at me. I said, he wasn't shooting at you in particular. I said, if anybody, they were shooting at me. I said, they're not shooting at anybody, actually. They can't see us. But could I convince them? But that's the way it was with them. You see, they, mind you, they had to learn the hard way, you know, and it was a difficult way of learning. But then, of course, everybody learns the hard way in action. And either you learn it or you die. I suppose that's the way it is. But that's the way it was at the Zuli. And I think the fact that I went to Captain Stevens, as I said earlier, and spoke to him about the morale of the men, and that they were saying, why is it always us going on patrol? He said, I go on patrol. I said, oh, I know you do. So, yeah, you know, but I didn't mean that. I meant, is there no way we can get any rest for them? So it eventually ended up with people from headquarters being brought up. And I think that was a little bit of a nasty smear, you know, that they had to drag out cooks, maybe, you know, something like that, or people in headquarters.
You mean it made them feel ashamed?
No, not that made them feel ashamed. They were just as entitled to do the job as anybody else, but I think it made Captain Stevens feel a little bit, and it certainly made me feel a little bit ashamed that we had to have somebody else coming in to do our job, you know. Not that it made any difference to me, because I still had to go. But instead of having my own men, or the men of the troop, they were intermixed with them, with some strangers from headquarters and things like this, you know. And I think that it didn't last long, but, that was just one of the little unpleasant things that crept in about there. And it always stuck with me, you know, that just for a matter of a few more days, as it turned out, had they been knuckled in and they were tired, I suppose, you know, and they were worried and that, and you know, we were taking casualties because, as I said, the Germans weren't idle either, because there were sometimes we ran into their ambushes, you know. They'd already have a patrol out, and they were unfortunate to run into them, you know, because they chose the same places as we chose, perhaps, you know. And there was quite a few times when we thought it was an attack going in, and it's just that the two patrol had bumped. But there was a bit of firing and a lot of anxious moments. People, their confusion, people not knowing what was going on until eventually it all settled down again and we were able to piece the story together. So that was how I remember this place. I'm sure it was called the Zuli, and it wasn't a very good one. My memory said that one. But then we made the breakout there from there. That was when the time came for the Falaise Gap being closed. And the change that came over the troop then, when in actual fact one morning we were told to advance, and Captain Stevens said, it's going to be funny. We're going to march out of here, he said, and we're going straight up that road. So looking at that road, the feelings that we've had for the past week or two, you know. And lo and behold, we went out and we marched for miles. Miles and miles and miles. We came across little bridges that had been partly blown. There was mines around them, and there was there where in some cases the charges hadn't exploded, and they were hanging there. It only partly destroyed the little bridges over the little rivers and streams, and we walked for miles. I never saw a soul. Never saw any sight, no sight of any Germans at all.
So suddenly the Germans had disappeared.
Yeah. Now where they got that intelligence from, you know, it's amazing. But somewhere along the line, they piece all this information that you keep bringing back to them, and from that, and from their own observations, maybe aerial observations as well, they get the, and they know exactly where to go. And we just got up and walked straight out where the day before we'd been afraid to lift our heads, and the next day we just got up and walked away. And I don't know how far we marched without seeing anybody. But they eventually decided that it would be better if we all went back again and got ourselves organised and went forward as a complete body and took everything with us, rather than go out in long patrols like that with no food and no water and no preparation for a long march. So we came back again, and the next time we went out, we covered the same ground again and went much, much further. And it was amazing the way the morale changed. Absolutely fantastic. Once the fellas got out on the feet and they started walking again and they started moving forward, they were different men altogether. And it was a case then of, after the first couple of days, we started a leapfrogging movement with the airborne. But they had transport, and we had to walk. But we did get these, our 1500 weight trucks came up, and these guys, and they would, we'd load all our stuff in, which was only a pack with a blanket, just throw it in, and then we'd march with our fighting orders on, our fighting equipment, and we'd march all day, and then at night time, this truck would come up, and we'd unpack it, and get down, and the next morning, same procedure again. But we were far too slow, you see, because we were walking. And at first, we were getting sent off to little areas where they'd had information that there was pockets of resistance or something like that. And, sometimes you'd find them there. Like one occasion, we came over the hills, and it's a beautiful countryside, marvellous. And such a pleasant walk, you know. That's all, the only way I can describe it. And if you weren't in the front, it was a pleasant walk. And you just strolled along there, and we came over these hills. Like just hilly country, you know. It wasn't mountainous, you know. It's just nice, just folded in the ground, you know. Trees and growing on them, you know, it's very nice. And we got to one place, and he said, right, we're going to sweep down now into the shallow valley in between this high ground, and an extended line, just as we were on the top. Now there must have been about about 30 or 40 men. And we hit there. I'm just talking about our troop now.
Where was this?
There was no particular place. I can't remember, you know, any. But this was after the breakout. And we just marched through the countryside, you see. And on this particular occasion, we'd taken little side lanes. And we'd gone up into the hill, hilly is the only way I can describe it. They weren't very high, only a few hundred feet. And they were more like, you know, big folds in the ground, I suppose, if you could see it from a distance. And we all lined up and came straight down. And it wasn't that, you know, it was only a few hundred yards that we're going down, you know, it was 400 feet, only 100 yards really, isn't it? 110 yards or something like that. And we went down, and there, in the middle of this field, four German 88mm guns. And we just swept right through them. And whether the Germans had seen us, But there were some explosions took place after we passed through it. But they didn't do very much damage to the guns, if nothing at all. And we shot one. One German got shot. And although I didn't see any of them running away or anything like that, and it was quite a surprise to suddenly find that we'd captured four 88mm guns intact, just out of the blue. But that night, there was a little village at the end of a little road, crossroads, actually, but they weren't, it wasn't a big road, they were very minor. And there was a crossroad, and on the corner stood a bank. And for some unknown reason, the Germans were shelling this place, started to shell it. And there were just at regular intervals, the shell had come over, and it would land somewhere in the vicinity of the crossroads. And it would hit the bank was getting hit and the various houses close by. But generally speaking, they must have been aiming at the crossroads. And we took up a position just this side of the crossroads after going through this battery. And there was no sign of any more Germans there, so they just sent patrols out. And unfortunately, another troop, which is in some other area, sent their a patrol out. And we had a little firefight between ourselves, actually, and killed two of our own men, one on each side. Which is a bit distressing, but there's one of those fortunes of war when things get a bit too fluid. And then the next day, we moved up into the village properly to make sure it was clear. And we cleared the village, and I got the job of guarding the bank and guiding the airborne through. But they came along in armoured cars, and they had some light tanks. And when they come down the road, I got a piece of a door, and I chalked on it. It was chalk in the bank. I found chalk in the bank, and I chalked on it, dash across the crossroads, accelerate across the crossroads, quick. And I just stood in the doorway, and every time I heard the bump in the distance, of course, I dived inside and got my head down, hoping that they didn't hit the bank. But I had my section around the bank. When the airborne were coming through, I kept popping out, this sign, tell them to get over, And or if I heard the pop, I'd stop, tell them to stop. And, of course, the shell would explode somewhere around the crossroads somewhere, and then he waved them on. Of course, they didn't know what the situation was, of course, and they did obey you. They say you got a crossroads, any casualties. And it was more important to when they had these 3-ton vehicles that carried the troop carrying vehicles, and when they were coming, they were full of troops, so you wanted to get them across without any trouble. So they would come through you like that and go on for X number of miles ahead of you. And then the next day you would go through them. And eventually they were lending us their troop carrying vehicles. So we were getting ferried then by transport. And we didn't, we were making fast progress then. And it wasn't until we came to a place called Pont Duoch.
How do you spell Duoch?
It was spelt as P-O-N-T hyphen D-U. Pont Duoch. I don't know if it's Pont Duoch or Pont Levesque. Pont-Levesque. I think it was Pont-Levesque. There's something about Pont Duoch, though, that something happened there. But anyway, this place, the